Welcome to the Lighter Side of the Dark Side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio and all podcast catchers, Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube, wherever you're catching us. It's the Dark Mark Show. I am Dark Mark, the goth comedian. And unfortunately, or actually fortunately in this case, my normal co-host, Nicole Six, was initially unable to make the show. So who do I get as a co-host? Somebody who's a way bigger star than me. And somebody who is a superstar. And actually, this is germane to the conversation we're going to have. But it's so great to see you again, and so great to have you on the show again. It's probably, I've told you, you are likely the first, but not the only, because I showed you there's been a lot in your wake. The first disabled sex symbol nationwide. Former anchorwoman, former actress, former so many things. Former reality show star. You've seen her at Carnival. You've seen her on Nip Tuck. You've seen her all sorts of places. It's Bree Walker.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's really sweet of you. At least I'm not an AI at this point yet.
Not yet, but
they're coming.
Well, I know. I'm sure there's somebody. There's probably somebody doing an AI Bree Walker right now, trying to figure that out using your voice, using your face.
Creeps well, now they will. Good job, yeah. Mark.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do. I had nothing to do with it. I want the real thing. I don't want AI.
But, it's very scary to me.
I'll bet somebody's got one of these things, which is I got this at the Adult Video News Awards. This is like a virtual reality thing.
Wow.
So they probably got some like AI Bree Walker right now. Going, but
what do you see through that?
Huh?
What do you see through that?
No, you put your phone in there and then you could see it's like it's virtual reality. It's 3D all around. And this one's used for porn, but there's other things to do with most people. It's either porn or video games.
Party.
Yeah. Well, somebody's shushing us, and that's our guest today. And she is quite...
That's my bad. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's fine. That's fine.
Somebody entered the room, I think.
No, I know how it is. I know when it's... I don't have anybody here, but I know there are people that we've had recording that people have popped into the...
Two teenagers, a dog, and a life partner. And yes, the teenagers are less than thrilled that I've taken over the living room to record.
I'm sure. So anyway, we're going to talk to, because Bree is, as people know, is a disabled advocate. One of the people that is responsible for the passing of the Americans for Disabled Act, which George Bush passed, and Bree was there for the signing. Somebody who has benefited from that, or I has not benefited from that, but should have, is somebody who's working as a disabled activist right now. Also wrote a book about all of her tattoos, and you guys can compare tattoos later. And has done so many things. It does so many things. She's Nerdzilla. She's
yes.
Somebody who has she has reinvented herself as a podcast host, as a blogger, as an activist. As there's so many things to you. There's just I can't narrow it down.
So many hats.
You're a hyphenate, and that's what we like to have on the show. It's Kelly J. Mendenhall.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I was listening to an episode where you had interviewed a former playmate, and she was a hyphenate, and you were like, "You're many hyphenates. I love it." And I said, "Well, he's gonna love me then."
Yeah, I don't like to interview people that are just one thing. I like to interview people that say something. And that was, by the way, that was a show with Deborah Driggs, and she's wonderful. And I recommend everybody listen to that. Bree, I don't know if I sent you that show, but that was good. I will now. She gave me actually some good advice that I was able to use. And forget the past shows. I want to be in this moment, and I really need to. You have so much going on. I have to keep up with your energy. So this is why I'm drinking this. Let me see if I can get in the camera here. There
your
it is.
Green screen. Oh,
yeah, my green screen is washing it out.
I'm just drinking iced tea out of a boring tumbler.
No. I'm drinking this. This is Raise energy drink. This is the best energy drink. I've tried them all. I tried the energy drink shaped like a bomb. I tried the energy drink that had horny goat weed in it. I tried the Steven Seagal energy drink. This is better. This not only
Steven
does it
Seagal
taste the best.
Has an energy drink?
Not anymore, but he used to. And it was actually really effective. It woke you right up, but it just tasted, it was like the worst tasting drink I've ever had. Not like this. Raise is great. This is actually Baja Lime flavor, which tastes like Baja Blast from Taco Bell. They also have Voodoo Fruit Punch. They have Galaxy Burst that tastes like Fruity Pebbles. Sour
Gummy
Worms.
Are they sponsoring this episode?
Yes, they are.
Should be.
Well,
okay,
that's what I'm talking about. Trust me, I'll throw in some other sponsors later, but this is good. The reason this is the best, not only does it taste great and really work, because I'm talking a mile a minute, so it's already working. I just had a couple sips. But zero calories, ooh, zero carbs, zero crash. They don't have these at 7-Elevens and grocery stores. They have these at GNCs and vitamin shops. But why pay full price? Go to the code in the description of the show. Get 15% off a case of Raise
Energy. Oh, yeah, for sure. Get that 15% off code.
What flavor are you drinking, Mark?
That is Baja Lime, which tastes like Baja Blast. It's like a, it's really good. It's kind of a lime soda sort of thing. It's really good. And that's my favorite flavor. I was going to get something else, and I was like, you know what? Why mess with that? I like this one. And that was.
I don't think I've ever seen you without an energy drink in your hand.
That's right. That's right. And you'll never see me without this particular energy drink from here on in. Great. So, Kelly was born and raised in Flint, Michigan. Or maybe you weren't born
that's
in Flint,
true.
Michigan, but you were raised in Flint, Michigan.
No, I was born there. Yep. And genuine Flintstone, as we call it.
You're a Flintstone. Now, you, as far as I know, basically came of age right when Flint was imploding and the GM plant was.
You are really accurate. You really did your research, too. That's exactly right? Correct.
This is like Roger and me sort of time frame.
Exactly. I was born in 1982, so it was literally the year that Roger Smith and all that happened, and they sent all of the jobs south. So I was born into what was going to become a fast failing city. And yes, people often remember that era from the Michael Moore film, Roger and Me.
Right.
And I've had people be like, was that real? Yeah, it was real. I mean, some of it, I think, was they always zhuzh it up a little bit to make it more interesting and dramatic, but like it was, and just like the Netflix documentary Flint Town, that was accurate, and I could point out places that, like, I was watching Flint Town and they drove by the bar that my mom and my aunts used to get kicked out of all the time, listening for singing Aretha Franklin too loud. It was called the White Horse. And I was like, hey, I know that part.
What a thing to get kicked out for.
Yeah.
I know, right?
I mean, nobody could touch Aretha Franklin, but still. That's,
there's way worse you could do, though.
Oh, yes. We kicked out of bars for way worse.
Bree has some personal experience, but we're not going to touch on that. But trust me, I've been to karaoke, and let me tell you something. Every time somebody sings Bohemian Rhapsody or Meatloaf, I want to kick him out myself. But Aretha Franklin, it's okay. You're not going to touch her.
I'll tell you, coming from a place like Flint is interesting, because when people ask where you're from, or they make a comment on it, and you confirm, yes, it's Flint, they most 9 times out of 10, they have this look in their eyes, like imagining what they think it's like to live there or something. Like, it all flashes in front of their eyes. So I usually break the tension. I'm like, yeah, I made it out alive. Isn't that great?
You made it before the water got contaminated.
I don't know about that. They used to drain the Flint River when I was a kid to get all the dead bodies in the cars out of it. That's where everybody. So imagine my surprise when I heard that they had supposedly cleaned it up enough to drink out of in the first place. I had my doubts, is all I'm saying. But yeah, the Flint River was when I was a kid, I think once a year they would like drain it down so they could find
the cars and the dead bodies.
Yeah.
Bodies and other contraband.
And other evidence. Yeah. But never Jimmy Hoffa. Damn it. I was always hoping.
Elusive.
You know, they would do that in L.A., but we've had a drought the whole time, so we can see the dead bodies in the car, so we don't have to drain anything.
You don't have to drain anything.
But that's where you got into punk rock.
Yeah, so my oldest sister is actually 9 years older than me, and that is how I really got into punk rock, because she was listening to stuff way over my head when I was a kid, and I worshipped her, so I just wanted to, like, be around her and her friends. I remember being, like, 6 years old or No, it had to have been younger than that. It was after my dad passed. I was like maybe five. Right. And we lived in a trailer park after dad passed away. And they were like, her and her friends were making me pose with cigarettes and recite Dead Milkmen lyrics from the album Beelzebubba.
Right.
Like, that's one of my core memories.
That's very healthy for a six-year-old to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
That has something to it.
I mean, you know, I've seen some things, I've lived some life, but yeah. And she took me to my first hall show, my first underground Flint, Michigan punk rock hall show where there was a mosh pit. Mm-hmm. It was my 7th birthday and she somehow talked my mom into letting her take me. And I remember that a skinhead named Corey was the one who put me on his shoulders and like ran me around the mosh pit in a circle. Nice. It was definitely an experience for 7 years old. It was an experience,
it's kind of sweet in its own way.
Crazy. It is. I mean,
I would imagine they would have a big, yeah, I would imagine they'd have a nice punk rock scene because, you know, I talked to, I don't want to brag and bring up past guests like I have been, but I talked to Glenn Matlock of the Sex Pistols a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
That was born out of just the similar situation where all the jobs left and there was just this industrial wasteland. So I would imagine Flint had a similar thing.
Oh yeah. It was very, well, and at the time too, so when I was growing up, like I was born in 82, but by the time the 90s rolled around, then you're into the Gulf War and everything. NAFTA has started, like all of these things compounding situations far beyond Flint, but they're all impacting the type of economy, you know, mm-hmm. with the industrialization and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it caught up to everyone in Michigan later because, like, I always say Southeast Michigan is kind of a world within itself. It's a state mm-hmm. within a state. It's very automotive industry based. That's where all the jobs are. Even the service jobs and everything depend on all those automotive workers and everything. And I think they were so used to the ebb and flow of union life and like the automotive world where you would work 6 to 7 days a week for like sometimes double or triple shifts, you know, mm-hmm. to like speed up production. And then you'd go through a period where everything would shut down for several weeks or several months. And that was just kind of the ebb and flow. And you would get paid while you were laid off, you know, not as much as you would while you were working, but that's what people were used to. And so when 2008 happened, that was to me when things got more interesting because I was older and I was able to understand it more. Mm-hmm. And it was like watching a slow train wreck happen, like statewide, you know, because I could see that all these people were just expecting that we were going through like another slump, like another, mm-hmm. like we're not going to have work for a few months, but it'll be good again. Mm-hmm. And I could see the writing on the wall and I could see it wasn't going to be just that. And so it was watching a devastated city be devastated all over again. And then flash forward to the water crisis. So it's like Flint breeds people who don't give up, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely one of them. And my mom is too. So, I think there's a lot. I think the city makes us a certain level of tough just by existing in it. And if you know how to hone it, it can benefit you later in life and you can apply that toughness in the right ways. Unfortunately, it can go the opposite way too. And you can apply that grit and that toughness in negative ways. Right. And so that's kind of why I always like break the ice with people and say, yeah, I made it out alive. Cause it's a hard place to be from without people automatically judging who you might be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that a Midwest thing? Cause I know Bree's from Minnesota and that bred a definite toughness into you.
Yeah. I was born in Oakland, California, but raised in Austin, Minnesota, where the Hormel meatpacking plant is. And it's literally one industry town. And because they laid off so many workers, Austin too has gone through a Great Depression, not like Flint, Michigan, not at that level because Austin is a tiny town, but there was only one industry. And when that meatpacking plant closed down, all the jobs left Austin. And the only thing that was thriving were the bars.
Wow. Yeah, that's how it was in Flint. It was like used car dealerships, strip clubs, and bars were the only things that stayed full.
Yeah.
And now there's dispensaries, but, if you just want to chill out and you don't need a dispensary, you can go to one of our other sponsors, Renegade CBD. And they have gummies, they have white chocolates. They also have, and I've got some coming, Bree, so I'm going to give you some of these, the CBD bath bombs.
Ooh.
So if you need to relieve the stress, get some CBD bath bombs from RenegadeCBD.com. Now, Kelly, I didn't have a chance to read your book. I will. What was the first tattoo you got? And how old were you?
I was 16. I had just graduated from high school a year early. So it was about 6 months before I turned 17. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, it's on my right thigh, and it's actually a picture of like a comic book character type, mm-hmm. Cart, like it was something an ex-boyfriend in high school drew. And okay. I just really was drawn to her. And so I had her tattooed on my leg. And I can send you photos if you want. My book has all the color photos of the tattoo. So in every chapter, I tell the story mm-hmm. of behind a tattoo and like whatever life circumstances inspired me to get it. And then there's full color photographs.
And how many do you have now?
Oh, gosh. Everybody asked that. And I stopped counting somewhere around 30. So I don't mm-hmm. really know. I think it's like 35 or 40, but. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure.
Because you got the whole sleeve and all that, and the chest.
I do. I don't know how much you can see, but I have I have that whole sleeve done. This one's partially done. Mm-hmm. I've got a whole chest plate, stuff on my back and my legs.
Now, do you count the chest plate as one or as several?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I just count it as one, even though it was the pain of 20.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And she's got you beat, Bree, so far, but you're catching up.
My tats are not very many, but they're in strategic places.
It's funny, I always say in my former life, before I was disabled and then when I was working full time and stuff, I used to actually give talks at different places, Rotary groups and things like that. About my tattoos, and I would always say that my body told my life story if you knew how to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then flash forward to 2017, all of a sudden I become medically disabled and I can't move.
Right.
And I was eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich one night on the couch because I couldn't make myself any food or anything. I couldn't stand up for any length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there eating my peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I was like, the idea for the book came, and I just said, skin in the game, the stories my tattoos tell. Or at first I just said, the stories my tattoos tell, and then my friend Amber, who's also an author, said, you should add skin in the game.
That's great. It's a great, nice touch.
So,
good title.
Now, I've heard you on other podcasts say that, I am curious how you got from Michigan to Tennessee, but you were saying how you've been discriminated against because of your tattoos at workplaces. Is that still a thing? Because everybody I know has tattoos. Like everybody. I'm the only one that doesn't. I feel
it's
discriminated
still a
against
thing
myself.
In a lot of places. No, I think it depends on where you are, but yeah, in Tennessee, I had a couple jobs where they didn't care and I could show my tattoos all I wanted. And then I had the last job I had working out in the world, I had to wear turtlenecks even like in the middle of summer or sweaters or whatever to cover
all of it.
Because if I had like a dress shirt on, you could see some of my chest plate. So they, mm-hmm. no, gotta have the like high collar.
Yeah.
And I don't think it should be a thing, but it's a thing.
I think it's being less of a thing, honestly. I mean, I live in LA, so that's a whole different thing. And
LA is its own world too.
Right.
From what I've heard.
But I think, especially the last 10, 15 years, people that don't have tattoos, such as myself, are the minority now.
Yeah, that's
really are.
I like to call folks with no tattoos plain skins.
Okay, well, I am a plain skin. I'm a plain skin, and
how'd you come up with the name Spooners?
Oh, Spoonies. So that's from the spoon theory. So I write a lot about the spoon theory, and I can never remember how to say her name correctly, so I'm not going to butcher it. Mm-hmm. But the spoon theory was proposed as a way to explain to a friend what it's like to live with a chronic invisible illness or disease. So this woman has lupus, and she's sitting in a diner, and her friend says to her, "What is it like to be you? Like, what does a day in your life look like having lupus and experiencing all the pain that you do? Like, how do you get through the day?" And no one had ever asked her that before. And so they're sitting in this like diner. I don't know. It was in the North Pacific Northeast, I think, maybe in New York, but they're sitting at a diner, and she grabs all of the spoons from the surrounding tables and holds them and hands them to her friend like a bouquet and says, "Okay, you have lupus." And she basically said, these 13 spoons represent all of the energy that you have to get through the day. And so what might take you one spoon to complete would take me three spoons to complete. So they walk through a day in her life, and she says, "Okay, how many spoons would it take you to take a shower and get dressed and go to work in the morning?" And her friend's like, "One. I do that in like 30 minutes. And she goes, "Okay, well, it takes me like whatever, two or three. And so they kind of went through that process, and the spoons are going away one after the other. And at the end of the thing, it's not even the end of the day, and she's out of spoons. And the original author, it's Christine, it starts with an M, but the original author said, "Okay, so this is what happens to me a lot. I get to the end of the day, or I run out of spoons before the end of the day is even here. So now I'm operating negative spoons. Now I have negative energy. And so that's going to cause a pain flare. It's going to cause these symptoms to happen. And then I have to try and sleep and get up the next day and be in a, I'm in a flare, and I have to get up and function the next day." And so it got really popular really quickly on the internet, and people really started identifying with that. And it became easier for a lot of people, especially with invisible disabilities. It became an easier way to communicate to people that you, like, it's not that you're flaking out. It's not that you're canceling plans. You literally don't have the spoons left to meet and have dinner or have that phone call you planned. And I think for me, I grabbed onto it tightly and identified with it, because mine, when I first became disabled, it was all a mystery. Nobody knew what was going on. I was just in this horrible mind-numbing pain, and I had no range of motion in my legs. It was horrible torture to try and walk. And nobody knew.
Did this just happen all of a sudden? Just like one day it happened, or it was a gradual thing?
It felt like that, but it was probably a gradual thing that started. I mean, I had a lot of physical trauma when I was in my teen years and early adulthood. I'd been in some car accidents and things, and I never had insurance. So we were like the kids that if you got into a car accident and the ambulance came, you would turn away the ambulance and get a friend to drive you to the hospital because you can't afford the $500 mm-hmm. fee for the ambulance, you know? So I think not having access to care and things, I think I had a lot of different injuries and things that existed because of who I am as a person and whatever my genetic makeup is, that I think were exacerbated by the fact that I didn't have access to care for most mm-hmm. of my life.
Sure, exacerbated by that.
You're right, because a lot of what has happened and come to light probably could have been prevented, or at least the damage could have been minimized, but because doctors didn't believe me about the pain and things that I was experiencing, And I was being gaslit constantly by them because they would say things like, well, there's nothing on the MRI to justify the pain that you're saying you're in. Or, you know, there's nothing obvious that would show why you would be experiencing loss of feeling or use in your legs or your arms. And it's like, okay, I get that you're not seeing why it's happening, but it's happening.
Right.
And they just didn't believe it. And what it ended up, I mean, it was a mixture of things. But what happened most majorly in my spine was that I had a ruptured disc right under my bottom rib, right where your thoracic spine and your lumbar spine meet. And because no one believed me for so long, it went unchecked for years and it grew into a calcified mass. And so it was crushing my spinal cord and deforming my spinal cord. Jesus. And it took 2.5 years to figure that out, to get to the right doctors, to finally figure that out. When I found the neurologist who discovered all that was happening in my spine, he said, I don't get what they've been doing to you for the last 2.5 years. They've run every test in the world, done every scan in the world on the part on your low back, but nobody bothered to look at the rest of your back. And I said, well, I asked at least 3 different doctors for MRIs of my full spine, and they all said no. Like, and he was just baffled. He couldn't believe it.
I can't believe it either. And that's why I'm asking, because you're saying this is gaslighting. I just think it's a competence or laziness. And
sometimes it is.
Also, is this like an insurance thing too? Like they weren't getting paid for it and they were.
No, my insurance was paying for everything. Like first, they thought I was drug seeking. How it felt to me was that at first they thought by looking at me and having all the tattoos and I was young, you know, I was like 34 or whatever. I think they looked at me and thought I was drug seeking. But then when I refused to take, when they did offer me narcotics and opioids, I said, that's not a plan. Cause they said, you need pain management. And I said, what does that look like to you? And they said, well, we would send you to physical therapy for 6 weeks and put you on, probably, I think they said, brain fart, one of the oxycodone, whatever.
Yeah.
And I said, that's not a care plan. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, you're not just going to throw me on heavy sedative pain medications that often don't work for nerve pain anyway. It just makes you so stoned that you don't care that you're hurting, in my experience.
That's welcome to healthcare in 2023.
Right.
That's what it is.
So, I mean,
a lot of people will say, too, oh, you're talking to a hypochondriac.
Or a hysterical woman. And I'm sure you've experienced this, Bree. Like they, you know, when you're a chronic pain patient, they have to ask you every time, are you feeling hopeless? Are you feeling helpless? Are you feeling suicidal? Is the pain interfering with your quality of life? And every time I would say, yes, 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 yes. I was like, 10 and a half months of being trapped on a couch, not being able to walk, and no one can tell me why. And all these doctors are like accusing me of lying. And I'm like, I wanted to die if that's what the rest of my life was going to be like. And I thought that by telling them, because when I wouldn't take the opioids, they said, well, then you must not be in that bad of pain. If you're not willing to take the pain medications, you must not be in that bad of pain. And I said, I'm 34, not 80. You can't just slap me on a bunch of addictive meds and send me on my way. I need to find out what's causing the pain and fix that. And then we'll talk about pain management, right?
Right.
And they yeah, they couldn't pick which lane they wanted to be in. I was drug seeking, and then I was like an obstinate patient, a non-cooperative patient. And then, like you said, they treat you like you're a hysterical woman. I thought being honest with them about how miserable the pain was making me was the right thing to do. But what it really did was convince them, oh, well, she has anxiety and PTSD in her medical history. So this is all a figment of her imagination. This is all trauma. It's all anxiety.
Bree, do you have any horror stories about doctors treating your medical condition or possibly your children?
They just didn't really know what to do with me because ectrodactyly is rare. And when it's a complete complicated case as mine is, that means it involves both my hands and feet. And it's extreme in its shape. Doctors just really didn't know much about it. So I've actually been written up in medical journals that are read by doctors now. My daughter came across one when she was looking for some help for her daughter, who also has ectrodactyly. And the doctor said, well, all we know of is one patient who's written up in the medical and she happens to be someone who's on television. So we can tell you about her, but we can't tell you much about your own situation because ectrodactyly has its own unique shape and the things that go with it. Luckily, not a lot of internal stuff, but a lot of external stuff and a lot of external pain. Trying to shove my feet into shoes that are meant for conventional feet, you know. And the arthritis that comes with the aging.
How did you deal with that while you were a media personality? Like, were you constantly trying to force yourself into like clothing and shoes to look presentable or whatever on TV and just sitting there in pain? Like, what was that like?
Originally, I was on radio first, rock and roll radio, doing as a DJ. So it really didn't matter then because, I wasn't seen. But once I transferred into the television news business, I at first wore prosthetic gloves for the first 3 weeks of that work. And to my boss's credit, he said, well, we've tried this experiment with you having the prosthetic gloves, and it just looks like you're not normally acting with gesticulation.
Right.
And we want you to take off the gloves and see how that works out. And I just had this huge sigh of relief at the fact that he wanted me to test the waters. And he said, if you're not accepted, then we're going to have to let you go. But if the public accepts you, then we've crossed a huge bridge into normalcy, and you can start to be what you should be, which is someone who gesticulates with their hands, as you know, from the waist up person, right? So,
well, you haven't done so on this show so far, but you will, I'm sure, at some point.
There you go.
Okay, great. I'm glad. I want to make sure everybody. Yes.
Unusual, you know, unusual hands, and
I've held those hands. They're lovely.
Yes, we've walked the beach together.
Yes, we've held hands on the beach, I was going to say. I mean, it's both of you have conditions that just baffled medical doctors and.
Yeah.
It just sounds like they just didn't put the effort in to really understand what was going through. Now you say that's a bias against females. I just think it's just they're just incompetent and they're lazy and they just want to drug people.
Laziness.
You would think that, but if you look at all of the clinical and legal research that has been done to test those waters, it literally comes down to being a man or a woman. If you're a man and you walk into an emergency room in the United States, you'll probably get pain medication if you're reporting pain about an average of 60 minutes faster than a woman. I mean, like the statistics begin to drive you mad, especially as a woman, because you're like, how am I supposed to combat all this? I don't know if you ever experienced this, Bree, and it might be different for people with invisible disabilities that people don't see unless you tell them, but I think, oh crap, I just lost my Sorry.
No, I was gonna ask Bree about that.
Chronic pain causes brain fog.
No, I was gonna ask Bree about that because I know you've dealt with all sorts of, I mean, you've been an activist for years, especially being a face on TV. You must have encountered people with quote unquote invisible disabilities that wasn't apparent.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that was so humiliating for me was when I was on camera and I got pregnant, there was a radio talk show host who decided to make me an example of how you shouldn't be allowed to be pregnant if you have an obvious physical deformity that is known to be congenital and could be passed along to your child, which in my case was with both of the children. They have.
And by the way, a really shitty radio host, Tom Likas, you suck, but go ahead.
And it was Jane Morris who was filling in.
Well, he's no longer on the air, but he still sucks. Go ahead. Yeah.
He does, in my opinion. Horrible. And anybody who filled in for him was of
what
the
a
same
dick.
So. This dude had a radio show where he taught guys how to pick up on girls. The guy's disgusting looking. The guy's like a 300-pound. He looks like Jabba the Hutt.
Is he an incel? Because that sounds like the recipe for an
incel.
No,
he hasn't
to
been
me.
On the air for like 20 years, but he sucks. But go ahead. I didn't mean to mention him. But yeah.
there were articles
in the LA Times about it, too. I mean, there were. He wasn't the only one that was questioning whether you should be, because you were. I shouldn't mention him either, but you were married to Jim Lampley at the time. It was a very high-profile coupling, and you guys were actually the inspiration for the movie Anchorman because you both were anchor people on the same newscast. That
you were. That's where the inspiration for that movie came from.
Yes,
you are just too cool. You have the coolest, like you have the coolest repertoire.
Thank you.
I really wanted you two to meet because you two are very cool.
I love it. Like I'm so excited that
I'm the least interesting person on the show.
Come on, you're at least as interesting as us. You're here.
I don't know about that, but
you got us here.
But when you were an activist, now do you have a story about somebody that had a disability that wasn't apparent, Bree?
So I actually was an accidental activist when it came to this stuff. I didn't mean to be. I actually have two friends whose mystery diagnoses I helped get solved by advocating for them with doctors. And one of them has a Chiari malformation, which means that her brain is too big for her skull, and it was pushing out of her skull and pressing on her spinal cord and causing a bunch of different problems.
Wow.
And of course, everybody had been telling her for years that she was just fat and had migraines. You have menstrual migraines. You're too fat. And it turned out it got pretty bad.
And they never did an X-ray or a brain scan?
No.
Wow. No. MRI would have shown that immediately.
And it was just like, I don't know. It was frustrating. The only reason why we got them to do anything at all was because she said, I fell off a mini bike last week. And the nurse said, did you lose consciousness? And she said, no, just pride. But the nurse was watching her fall like in and out of like, really, it was like she was unconscious, but not. It was really bizarre. She was having crazy symptoms because her blood pressure was like dangerously low, and she was just kind of in and out of delirium. And I pulled the nurse aside and I said, I am her best friend, and I know her medical history, and I know her cycle. We're on the same cycle. It's a whole ass thing. Like, I know something's wrong. She might not have lost consciousness when she fell last week, but it wasn't like her to have that happen either. Can you please talk them into doing something, a scan? And the nurse talked the doctor into getting a CT scan, and that's how they found it. And they had to like take her by ambulance to another hospital. And so that was the first time. And then the second time, it was a neighbor. I had moved to Nashville for what I thought was my dream job in 2013. And I got laid off like less than a month into it because they lost their funding, basically. And so all of a sudden I'm in a new state, unemployed, like freaking out. Mm-hmm. And my neighbor upstairs, her dog and my dog became best friends. And through the course of our friendship, I started seeing all these things. Like, she would have delirium. She would sometimes fall. She would have falling spells. She's very, like, I'm not saying that the doctors weren't right to consider her weight as a factor,
mm-hmm.
because she was very morbidly obese. However, it was too easy for them to just say, oh, she's just fat, right? Oh, you gotta lose weight. Well, what was actually happening? And again, I had to talk to a doctor. I said, look, I'm with her every day. She lives above me. I see these things happen. She's losing her vision. She's falling. She's fainting. She's delirious and says nonsensical things. There's something going on. Just look at it, please. And the neurologist did scans, and she had her spinal fluid was not draining correctly. Mm-hmm. So it was building up. It's called like pseudotumor. So the fluid builds up in your skull and creates pressure on your brain, and it's pressing on different parts of your brain. So it starts mm-hmm. to affect different neurological systems. And they had to put a shunt in her brain. And as soon as they put the shunt in her brain, all of the headaches, the delirium, the falling, all of that stopped. Mm-hmm. Those two things happened within like the 10 years leading up to my disability. So I had had some practice with it, working in the nonprofit sector with under-resourced communities. I advocated for them a lot. So I had to apply a lot of what I knew from real life experience to my own case once I found myself in that position. And I wanted to say, you mentioned laziness. Sometimes doctors are lazy, but more than that, a lot of doctors are very narcissistic. They don't like to admit when they don't know the answer to something. Right. So a mm-hmm. lot of times, instead of saying, it's very common, I think, that instead of saying like, I don't know how to help you, or I don't know what's wrong, they'll just say there can't be anything wrong because you're fine. And I don't see it. So it's not there. Mm-hmm. And it was a doctor who said to me, 11 months into my journey, he said, you're not crazy. I believe you. Your pain is real. Mm-hmm. You are a complicated case, but you're not an impossible case. And I mm-hmm. promise that if you don't give up on you, I won't give up on you. And he saved my life by saying that. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who started referring me to dozens of different specialists to try and figure out what was going on. But if you don't have a doctor who gives a shit.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, that's where we're at right now. That's where we're at right now. That sounds, you know, that guy sounds like, you know, you lucked out.
I did luck out. I did.
One of the things that happened to me when I was pregnant and working in New York City, on the news there, was that, because I was getting specialized examinations at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, they were really as forward-thinking as you would expect to be because of where it is.
Yeah. Right?
They're dealing with AIDS babies. They're dealing at that particular time. They're dealing with all kinds of strange anomalies with birth events, and they encouraged me to have an abortion. Encouraged me, which wow. I found offensive. Heartbreaking that this would be suggested to me, because it was obvious that the baby in my belly, which was my first of two children that I've had, had her feet pressed up against my uterine wall, so they could see the shape of her feet, which were claw-shaped feet.
So they tried to convince you to abort because of her feet?
They had me go to the chief of staff and have a conversation about my options, is what they said. Options. And so, and then fast forward to when I worked in Los Angeles at Channel 2, and I was being seen by Cedars-Sinai Hospital with my second child. That was, again, the situation. They sent me to the chief of staff to talk about my options, as though I would automatically want options since we knew that my baby was going to be born with ectrodactyly, this condition, you know? And right. I didn't want options. I wanted right. a baby. So right. I was, again, humiliated. So I had a public humiliation and a private humiliation that my then husband and I went through. And it was awful because not only did the talk show host continue to make this a whole deal during the last month of my pregnancy, it was also encouraged by the medical staff that I look at options. That was...
And it's so frustrating because they're such idiots, you know? It's just... It takes such ignorance and yeah. just a complete, I mean, they didn't want to have to look at what they didn't understand.
Right. On the flip side, there were a few doctors that were very progressively minded. And they said, you know what, you need to contribute your blood to the Human Genome Project so we can learn more about ectrodactyly and ectodermal dysplasia mm-hmm. and the other deformities and handicaps that go with deformed hands and feet. And so I did. I offered my blood and the blood of my babies to the Human Genome Project, and it got written up in manuals and got into medical literature and helped educate these doctors about this particular condition, which is rare.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a flip side. It's a minority.
And the other flip side yeah. is that this didn't happen in the age of social media.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my God, that yeah. would have been horrible. But
that would have been awful.
And we're almost an hour, and we've barely scratched the surface. Kelly, can you stick around for another half hour or no?
Yeah. Okay. Let's do it.
Well, let me do one of my horrible segues and tell you that. Because I know we've been talking about all that and doctors and everything, but if there's one thing the three of us can agree on, it's there's nothing sexier than a great smelling man, right?
That's yeah, true. We
love
that's
great smelling
that's
man.
Very true.
Well, I will tell you, if you're a man and our audience is predominantly male, and you want to smell great and you want to attract women, get Tactical Soap. That's one of our sponsors, Tactical Soap. You should get this for your life partner, Kelly.
This I feel like I'm gonna have to get this for Jeff.
Get this for Jeff because they have three different types, Bond, Durden, and Maverick. And they have three different flavors of all of those.
Okay.
They have lotions.
As much as he loves Top Gun, I have to buy a Maverick.
Yeah, Maverick. Clearly. So, yes. But this is soap that is infused with pheromones.
Ooh.
So I'm sure he turned you on as it is. But, man, if you smell like smell like Maverick, forget about it. So if you go into the description in the show, get your own Tactical Soap. Now,
you have a bar handing in the studio with you, Mark?
Yeah,
I don't. I have some Bond on the way, so I will let you know. But next time I see you, Bree, I'll be smelling. You'll get those pheromones.
That's where I was going.
So yes, so so you but I mean, your background is in marketing, and obviously now you have such a social media presence, Kelly.
Me? My yes. background was in nonprofit administration right. and fundraising and grant writing. And I took all of that and applied it to social media. Yeah, I just talked and talked and talked and to anyone who would listen for a long time and still do. Mm-hmm. Most recently, I was a keynote speaker for Disability Awareness Day here in Michigan mm-hmm. in Grand Rapids. And, my therapist wants to know if we can find a way to make me Miss Disabled America. And so maybe the Dark Mark show will make that happen. Now,
well you got to compete against Bree.
I don't know. Bree, we're
going
to have to co-host or something, the competition.
That would be lovely.
Wouldn't it be awesome to have something like that?
Who's the current? Is there a current Miss Disabled America? There's got to be.
No, that's not a thing.
Is there a lot of? And I was showing Bree. There's a lot of disabled models now.
Yeah,
with all sorts
of
conditions.
There are more and more. And there was a gal I saw on Shark Tank she's a clothing designer for people with disabilities. That was awesome. People are definitely, when I started writing about medical gaslighting, like, you have to understand, I was writing about it. I didn't know what the hell to call it at first.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading all this research that was telling me, okay, women are literally, like Jim Gaffigan, his mm-hmm. wife almost died from a brain tumor because doctors kept saying she was fine.
Right.
Like, I kept finding all these stories and I kept reading all this research and I'm like, this is real. Like, there is an implicit bias against women reporting, especially reporting pain in the medical industry. But I think I wrote the term medical gaslighting the first time in 2018. When I first mm-hmm. started writing about it and like trying to spread awareness about it, I was like, you know, now you get the trending hashtags that have like 1 million videos or whatever have used this hashtag. When I started writing about medical gaslighting and started trying to raise awareness, nothing existed. So I was the one with the medical gaslighting hashtags trying to get them trending and stuff like that. Now, and I took a 2-year hiatus from things a little bit because of my own mental health after going through everything that I did and ultimately 6 surgeries in less mm-hmm. than 2 years. I took a couple years off, but now it's like exploding. Like, people are making TikTok templates about medical gaslighting and like,
so basically they took what you invented and,
well, and
I mean, you took spooning invent- so they could take medical gaslighting.
Right. It's not inventing because, like, it's just an intellectual idea. It's mm-hmm. not a copyrighted thing. But
if only it was.
Makes me happy.
You'd be so rich now.
I know. But it makes me happy to see that so many people are talking about it now and that it is something that's part of more and more regular conversation because... And it does, medical gaslighting absolutely happens to men too. There's all kinds of trends in the data. It happens to women of color more often than it happens to Caucasian women.
Sure.
If you're more aesthetically pleasing, is how they've put it in the research that I've read. If you're aesthetically pleasing or put together, then you're more likely to experience medical gaslighting. Because if you look all put together and done up and done well, then you must not feel that bad. So I always tell people who are living with disabilities and going to doctors, I'm like, look like shit. Go in your pajamas if you have to. If it's a bad pain day, don't cover up your dark circles under your eyes with makeup. Go in there and look how you feel. Because
you let me down
sucks.
A road. I thought you were going the other way. Like, if they're hot, they get extra treatment. But no, you're saying that it's the opposite.
If you're hot, you get preferential treatment, or it might be easier for you to get treatment. But what I'm saying is, like, that's why I'm saying go into your doctor's office looking haggard. Because if you're super, they're not going to take you as seriously. And they might like placate you, but I don't know. It's just different.
Look how you feel is what you're saying.
Look how you feel. Yeah. Don't put on a show that looks like you feel great and you're not in any pain because it's wrong. I'm not saying it's right, but this is the system that we're operating within. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like smash down the walls while also like operating within the system that exists and figuring out how to get the help that you need.
Right. The existing bias does drive the train.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, I had all kinds of tricks. In addition to everything else, I'm an artist and I'm an embroidery artist mm-hmm. and I make like heirloom. You probably remember these, Brie. Like the applique and sequins and beads stockings from Bucilla that like I got mine from my great grandma Mabel when I was born. So that's the same style of things I do now. I do a lot of Christmas stockings and things like that. And I used to take that with me to doctor's offices because sometimes it was an icebreaker, so they wouldn't just see me as the tattooed person, the tattooed young person complaining about pain in their office. Mm-hmm. They would stop and see that, and you could see them like trying to figure it out in their head, like, wait, she looks like she might be a degenerate or a criminal, but she's mm-hmm. doing this really wholesome craft that, and like, it usually served as an icebreaker to make me more human to whatever doctor I was interacting with. So I would do that a lot going for like my first appointment with a specialist. I would make sure, plus it keeps you busy. Mm-hmm. I used to sit in waiting rooms for anywhere from 30 minutes to 3 hours. So, yeah. You know, you always need it.
You got to do something. Yeah. But,
yeah.
There are only so many highlights magazines you can read.
Everyone can relate to that long wait.
Or the National Geographics. Nobody wants to read the 1980s National Geographic right now.
Right.
Like, that's a thing.
Well, I do, but for a whole different reason. But that's an inside joke. The kids won't get that. Yeah. Yes. You got it. The kids won't know that. But so how did you ever figure out why your spine fused together and how that happened?
We fused it together on purpose. I had two spinal fusion surgeries, but what was happening was my spine has been degenerating and collapsing. Discs mm-hmm. have been collapsing and rupturing. And I think I've pretty much been told to accept that we probably won't ever know for sure what started the rapid decline. Again, I think when you work in the nonprofit sector, you work the job of two or three people and you get paid like a person's part-time salary. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult world to work in, and people there's not a lot of like time for self-care and shit like that. Right. Like you're on the go constantly.
Now what drew you to that?
Because I wanted to make the world a better place.
Now you
know
better.
I wanted to feel like I could do well for myself financially and do good in the world at the same time. However, mm-hmm. reality has determined that that is a lie, at least in the nonprofit sector.
Unfortunately, yes.
And I write about that in one of the chapters of my book. I write about like my disenchantment. I really did. I got into the nonprofit sector partly. My oldest sister, Amber, who also got me into punk rock, is mm-hmm. the one who got me into the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. And I was always very social, political, you know, active. I went for my first protest with my sister when I was like 7. Mm-hmm. I was always about the underdog, and I was always about fighting for what was right. And there are a lot of things in this world that I think are not right, and a lot of people suffer because of them. And mm-hmm. I wanted to feel like I was working in the sector that would allow me to have some kind of long-term positive impact. What actually happened is that I ran myself into the ground, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I burned myself out. And between college and grad school and then my career in nonprofit, together with not having access to care, like preventative care, I never had access to anything like chiropractic or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not having access to preventative care or consistent medical care, all of those things, I think, combined to create a trifecta of unfortunate events.
Well, from what I understand, you were not only doing more work than anybody else, and I can relate to this. You didn't have kids, so you were always the one working on weekends. So I definitely can relate to that. But also, the disparity between the men and the women was, and there's always a disparity in almost every field, but it was even more at the nonprofit than usual.
Yep. Yeah. And it was really gross, like how much nepotism there was in the nonprofit sector. Like part of me wanted to go into the nonprofit sector because I thought I would never be able to survive the corporate world, because I was just like, I hate dealing with fake people. I hate pretending to respect people that I don't respect. I hate cubicles. Like, I'm not super good at authority. I was like, I just feel like I'm not going to be able to fit into like a traditional job. And mm-hmm. to a blue collar kid growing up in Flint, Michigan, jobs out there in the world that existed to me were things like teaching, being a nurse, maybe being a doctor or lawyer if your parents could afford a decent school. I didn't think about, and 20 years ago or 10 years ago, there were a lot of things, a lot of people make money now doing things you couldn't do.
Right.
10, 20 years ago because of the technology.
Well, luckily,
I mean, being able, you know, being able to, I mean, I'm able to reach a much wider audience, and I think, and I hope positively impact way more lives now than I was when I was working the front lines of the nonprofit sector.
Sure.
Because now I can help other people feel left alone or less alone, and I can help them feel less alienated. And I've seen feedback from people who come to like my keynotes or whatever that say things like, she made me feel like somebody understood me. And she made me feel like I could survive what I'm going through. And if I can do that, perfect. My, like, that's what I ultimately want out of life. Yeah. If I can make a positive impact and help just some people feel less alone and and less afraid, it's really friggin' scary to be in that much pain or that sick and not know what the hell is going on.
Right.
And for me, unfortunately, at the time I was living with a total douche canoe who gaslit me just as much as the doctors, because the doctors were saying there shouldn't be anything wrong with me. So he was, of course, saying, well, then what's wrong with you? And he was always pressuring me for sex and things like that. I remember one time I looked at him and I said, I can't walk right now, but you think I need a 300-pound man on me? Like, no, dick. Like, just like, why? You know?
Yeah.
And so
nothing hotter than a woman who can't stand up and walk. So, yeah.
That's, right. Yeah. And I would be like, what is wrong with you? So I was being gaslit at home and by the doctors. But the community that I was able to connect with online and through social media, especially the Spoonie community,
right?
That was life changing for me, and that was what kept me feeling like I was connected to the rest of the world.
Now, is this around the time you started dubbing yourself Nerdzilla, or
no? So my friend Shane, who is actually in California, in Oakland, California, he is a wrestler. He goes by Riot. His dad is Shane Cody. Him and his dad and his grandpa were all wrestlers. And they were like the three generations of wrestlers. But Shane gave me the nickname Nerdzilla when I told him I was starting grad school. Because he was like, what are you talking about going to school? And I said, well, I'm going to grad school. And he's like, you just fucking graduated last year. And I was like, yeah, for the first degree. Now I'm going back. And he was like, dude, from now on, Nerdzilla. You are Nerdzilla. And so it was a nickname that stuck and that I loved a lot. And when I started writing about what was going on, I think I felt a little bit afraid to be entirely myself out in the public eye. Like, I felt like I needed a buffer between me and the world. And so Nerdzilla was kind of my buffer, because he became my mascot, my alter ego, kind of like it. Kelly Nerdzilla Mendenhall was just how I got to be known. And it was comfortable for me.
Also, you're hitting it at the time when nerds are cool.
Right. Also, in addition to all the medical stuff, I was going through a legal battle to get disability. So I had the government watching me all the time. I had to sue them for my disability. Bree, I'm sure you've had plenty of federal government like headaches in your lifetime, but I had to sue the federal government to get disability. So while I was going through all this stuff medically, I had none of my own income. I couldn't work. I was completely disabled and unable to work. But I also was in a state that doesn't participate in Medicaid. Yay, Republicans. Yeah. They don't participate in Medicaid. So, like, unless you have Social Security or you have children, you can't access any resources, like supplemental income. And I fell into the "you're screwed" category in Tennessee. So there was a lot of different things at play, and that made it harder to focus on my healing, right? Because I couldn't focus on getting better. I was too busy fighting to put all these fires out. And I went without income it wasn't until last year that I finally got paid. I finally won my case last June, and then they, of course, waited until October to finally pay me because...
But did they backdate it? Did they give you...
They did, but it's not as much money as people think. Like, I'll just be honest. People think that, oh, it was so much money. Like, you probably got so much money.
No, I don't think that at all. I know the federal government. I don't think you got a lot at all.
For 6.5 years of my life and all the pain and suffering and all the debt that I went into because the government wouldn't just give me my freaking benefits, I ended up with, like, less than $10,000 a year for all those years of my life. Like, that was some shit to get over too, you know. I was really mad for a minute because it's like, what in the hell have I done all this for and fought for so hard, and I'm literally looking at evidence that to the federal government I have like no value. And that was really difficult to undo that damage emotionally. It was really difficult.
Well, luckily I came to that realization a long time ago, so they don't give a shit about any of us. But maybe Bree, that's about it. But because she's on TV, but that's about it. I'm going to ask both of you, and I'm going to ask Kelly first and then Bree, what going forward should we be doing? What's the solution?
Thinking inclusively. There are still some, like, this world is so inaccessible to so many people with disabilities, whether they're invisible disabilities or obvious physical disabilities. This world is not inclusive. And there is a big difference between going into a public space that tries to accommodate you versus going into a public space that is built for you. A quarter of our population is living with disabilities. So we need to start making the world more accessible. We need to stop treating disability like it's a bad word. And we need to look at doctor-patient relationships as a cooperative partnership and not an authoritarian dictatorship.
And I would
stop using the handicapped bathrooms. Go ahead, Bree.
I would add to that that there's sometimes an assumption that it's contagious, whatever you have. And so there's a repulsion that people feel. I've noticed this when I've sat and waited in emergency, hospital rooms. Yeah. I've seen the stares, the constant evaluating of who is she, why is she formed this way. To some degree, because I managed to make a career in radio and then television, I got enough exposure that I was protected from some of that discrimination by the exposure, but I was also a target by the
exposure. Yeah.
So it was the same, I've been both edges of the same coin. But I would say that we are growing more inclusively because of efforts like yours. And just keep doing it, because really, I mean, I hadn't even heard the term spoonies before. And now I'm going to start thinking in terms of that, because I often don't think of myself as having a disability. And yet there are so many things, especially with today's packaging, which is,
oh God, I can't imagine.
I can't do with my hands. And
God,
you know, I live alone.
I can't even imagine.
So it's really a challenge, and I have to buy only what's easy to open. You know, something I've thought to.
I wonder I would like to know, would you rather people ask questions or avoid the topic? Because I feel like sometimes people ask questions. I feel like people assume that it would embarrass or hurt or offend someone, but they don't realize that the sideways looks and the awkward stares and all that is what's offensive.
Sometimes I'll notice, like, if I'm in a crowded room and there are other people with children, the children will stare at me. And if I get a chance, I'll say to the child, you know, if it's just in passing, whatever, I was born like this. It's okay. It doesn't hurt. And I just as a way to be advocate oriented toward that child understanding, because the child's going to take the understanding forward. We can't change what well ingrained human adults have stuck in their brains and their prejudices.
You're so right.
You know,
speaking of that, was that your experience when you were on Reading Rainbow?
Yeah, that was actually a lovely experience.
Now, did the children know in advance that you were coming and they're going to be talking about this, or no?
No, they didn't. They didn't. But the puppets that were part of the Reading Rainbow series were the ones that brought up the topic of disability, and here's someone unusual, and the children in the audience were fascinated. I mean, you could have heard a pin drop. It was really an amazing experience.
That's so cool. Well, see, you paved the way for people like me, and I'll keep paving the way for the next generation. Yeah. And I promise that I won't give up, just like you haven't given up, because it is important. And like, just like, you know, they say girls need to see girls on TV doing different jobs. Mm-hmm. Well, disabled people need to see heroes like you. Not all heroes wear capes, right? So, like, I need to see that there are other people before me that are approachable and who paved the way for me. And having you encourage me and say that I'm making an impact, well, that gives me enough energy and, like, a fire under my ass to go fight for another 20 years, you know, like that means a lot. So I promise to keep going. I promise to keep being a loudmouth broad.
Thank you.
Being a loudmouth broad, there's nothing wrong with that. And you've quit the nonprofit. That's a whole story. You've mentioned that on other podcasts, but now, I mean, you started your own podcast talking about a podcast.
Yeah. So I had a podcast called the Non-Mom Happy Hour, and our tagline was celebrating real ass human women, whether they use their baby box or not. And we would talk about different women who've done things.
It's too bad it's not on anymore, because you would have had a perfect show with Bree.
I know. It was a co-host thing, but I am looking at starting another podcast called the Medical Gaslighting Project. Mm-hmm. And my friend Noelle would be co-hosting with me. She lives with Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. We both have invisible disabilities and illnesses, mm-hmm. and we've both suffered a lot, but we have wicked senses of humor. So I'm excited to work on that with her. And right now, my biggest project is the Affordable Art Revolution.
Mm-hmm. You beat my segue to it.
So the Affordable Art Revolution is basically I make whatever makes me feel happy in my heart and soul every day. Mm-hmm. And I put it, whatever I make and create, I put in my online shop on my website. Mm-hmm. And people pay what they can. It's all pay what you can or name your own price. There's no wrong answer. And I tell people that all the time. I want to make art more accessible to everyone, and especially people like me who do live with disabilities and might need coping mechanisms for dealing with things like chronic pain and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And my stitching helped me survive all these surgeries and all the idiot doctors and all the things. I survived because I kept creating. I was writing and sewing, and I wanted to find a way that I could feel like I could supplement my disability income or even surpass and be able to tell the government, like, fuck you, I don't need your disability income. Like, how cool would it be if I could make art more accessible to everyone and expose more people, especially yeah. young people, to like folk art and handmade, hand-stitched things? And then maybe more people would start to come into this world as a coping mechanism, and they could build their own, you know, their own hobbies and make their own things. And why is art so untouchable for so many of us, especially on limited incomes, when art is supposed to be for everyone? It's supposed mm-hmm. to be like part of the human experience and something that brings everyone joy, but it's become this like elitist thing that you can't get a hold of. A lot of the times, women's artwork isn't considered artwork because things like hand embroidery and like they used to say, oh, that's not art, that's crafting. You know what I mean? So it's like I wanted to spread more joy and love to Spoonies everywhere mm-hmm. by getting my art into their hands. And mm-hmm. And so I, anything that's not a custom commission, people can order things like I do the Christmas stockings and people can order the kit that they want done and have it personalized. That I charge like locked prices for, but anything that I just make and put in the shop is all pay what you can. And basically people check out on the site for shipping and tax, and then which is like $5.99 usually. And then they can choose how much they add to my virtual tip jar.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Now, how's the pain now? How's the pain now?
It sucks, but I live in Michigan, and so I'm out of Tennessee and I'm in Michigan, which means I have plenty of access to medical cannabis. Michigan's mm-hmm. legal recreationally and medically. But the advantage of being a registered medical patient is you can write it off as prescriptions.
Mm.
You can write off that expense. So I manage my pain with anti-inflammatories, cannabis of all kinds, and muscle relaxers. And I actually go tomorrow. I currently have a collapsed disc in my back underneath where that spinal fusion is.
Ugh.
And it's causing me a lot of pain and trouble. I had a few falls in 2021, and one of those falls, I fell backwards into a bathtub, and I fell and hit my head and my back where the fusion is on the soap dish that's built into the wall.
Oh, no.
So for 10 months, sorry, I was walking around afraid to move. I was afraid to move for 10 months because I kept hearing a clunking sound in my spine, and we were concerned that it was like the hardware breaking, but what it actually is it took 10 months to figure it out. My bottom rib, they had to chip away some of the bone to make room for the hardware in my spine.
Mm-hmm.
And I hit it just right, so now my bottom rib just likes to like nope out whenever it wants on my sternum. Mm-hmm. Like if I move the right way, it just pops in and out of place. So the pain is not great. And tomorrow I have a procedure where I have to abstain from all of my pain management tools. And they're going to put a nerve block in my spine. It's a nerve blocking medication. They're going to put it in my spine where they think the pain is coming from that collapsed disc. And for 8 hours, I have to journal what my pain does. And then at the end of the 8 hours, all the pain comes back. Mm-hmm. And then you have to do the test a second time. And then if everything works out, then I'll get a nerve ablation to try and hold off the next surgery. So,
once again, I'm sorry I mentioned it. I guess pain is just still there.
And that's the thing about chronic pain and illness is like, I'm never not going to have a degenerated spine, and it's only going to continue to degenerate, but I can make the best out of my life as possible and have the highest quality of life possible. And mm-hmm. so that's what I strive for every day. Like I'm in my fancy medical recliner right now. I've got like an electric button that'll lift me up out of it, so I don't have to strain the muscles in my back trying to stand up. I mean, you find ways. I'm sure Brie has a million workarounds she has to apply to her life too. Yeah.
Right. I have to things be creative less painful. With all kinds
well,
of
well, people. you both are inspirations to everybody disabled and non-disabled that you guys Aww. Are doing great work. I could talk to you guys all day, but we, you know, it's been an hour and a half.
I know, guys, it's crazy.
When it goes by this fast, you know, it's a good show. If you guys have any questions for each other, please. I don't want to.
No, but Brie, is it okay if I link up with you on social media so I can stay in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Just I'll give you my email.
Brie's not on social media, but you guys are both on the same email. Okay. That I've All set right. the Zoom on, so you guys can communicate that way.
Yeah, email. Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna email you that and make you my pen pal.
I think that's
fair.
Had a bad experience with a guy a few years back, and I took myself off social media as a result.
Mm. Right.
And haven't really re-entered the area of dating or being on social media, and it's isolating. It is. It's an isolating feeling to not be on social media. But it's not for me yet.
Well,
I'll email you, pen pals.
You guys are BFFs now. Kelly,
we are.
One marketing tip you have for me, because I know that the show is fantastic. I want people to know about it.
I just think we need to, get your podcast out into more of the podcasting groups on social media and things. I don't know why, but Twitter, and I don't know now because it's a whole new world. Twitter used to be the way to grow podcasts.
Really?
Listeners. It's a whole community there. Like when you get into the community of podcasters on Twitter, at least it was for me, it was a completely different community. There was Lady Pod Squad and all these different groups, and there were some regional groups, and everybody kind of looked out for each other.
Right.
So most of the growth that I had in my podcast, I mean, you're doing well enough. You've got sponsors and you've got Renegade Radio and everything. But most of everything I did was like organic, like, beating your feet on the ground, you know, like it was all ground up stuff. So, but I will certainly help make people more aware of your show.
No, I appreciate it. I just, cause you, that's, you know, that is your background, and you do such a great job yourself that I was, you know, I'm always looking for tips. I'm always looking to expand the audience and, you know, so, but Kelly, you're fantastic and you got so much going on. I had such a great time. I would love to have both of you back for a second show.
I would love to. After you guys are
BFFs for 6 months or a year, we'll come back and see what you guys have cooked up together. But Kelly,
I'm down.
Tell everybody everything you got going on.
All right. So you can find everything that you could possibly want to know about me at kellyjmendenhall.com. My book is A Skin in the Game, The Stories My Tattoos Tell. I took that. The ebook is down to like 99 cents. When the pandemic hit, I lowered it to 99 cents and I just left it there. Again,
even I can afford that.
More accessible. Yeah, I'm just trying to be more accessible. It's hard with the printed copies. It's $25.99 because of all the color photographs. So, but the ebook comes with the photographs. So, and if you follow the hashtag Affordable Art Revolution, I'm on TikTok. Kelly J, author Kelly J Mendenhall. I'm on Instagram. I'm on all the things. And pretty easy to find and happy to talk to anybody. So,
yeah. Now, is there another Kelly Mendenhall? Because you have the J in there.
There are. And one of them has, so my email is, well, my personal email is just my full name at Gmail. And I keep getting emails for other Kelly Mendenhalls about wedding dresses, flight reservations, all kinds of things over the years. So I'd also, my dad who passed away when I was 4, his name was Jay, and he gave my sister her middle name, which was Jane, and he gave me my middle name, which was Jean. And I guess over the last few years I felt now that I've been through everything I've been through, I felt like I could put Nerdzilla down a little bit. Mm-hmm. He's still there. You can still get Nerdzilla stuff, but like
right.
now it's just Kelly J. Mendenhall, and I don't feel like I need that buffer between me and the world so much. So right. that's what that reflects. So
go to kellyjmendenhall.com and get all your needs. Mm-hmm. Follow you on social media, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, all that stuff. If you want to follow Bree Walker, you're out of luck. But I know her email and I know her number, and you don't. But Bree, thank you so much for being on the show.
I'll answer emails to Bree Walker Lampley at iCloud.com.
Right. Awesome. And Bree, thank you so much for being on the show. You're so overqualified to be my co-host. I keep telling you.
Silliness.
Thank you both for hanging out with me tonight. It's been really awesome.
Much, so much fun. And I am Goth Comedian on all social media. And everybody, have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.